Our next speaker is Dr. Margaret Owen. She's a specialist registrar in Glasgow. She has studied, reading theology in Cambridge before she started doing medicine in Manchester. And because she's only another year until she completed her training, she is hot property for anyone looking for a consultant to join them in the pain clinic. When I asked her about animals, actually I should tell you, just for information, Christine got 3 horses. And when I asked Margaret, she got 2 cats, no, sorry, 3 cats and 2 teenage daughters. Margaret. And another thing she asked me to mention, please, she is very keen and interested in heavy-duty tools. She likes buying lots of new tools all the time, and making furniture. That is somehow important to her talk.
Thank you very much. What a seamless introduction that proved to be in the end. I'm very glad to hear I'm hot property. I didn't realise. That's right. The link with tools, it was a very cheap way to link into the subject that I've been given to speak about. And the anecdote was going to be, I am indeed very keen on power tools and woodworking. And really, I constantly tell my family that the secret of success is having the right tool for the job, and that's why I'm going to spend £300 on this, whatever it is. And I had to revise my opinion a few years ago when I bought my brand new table saw, and the first thing I did was to slice the top part of my right thumb off. I think since then, my revised opinion is that tools are great, they're great fun, but they don't replace skill or expertise in any way. And I think that can be the theme for the talk. So I'm talking about assessment tools for neuropathic pain. You will probably be familiar with the updated definition from the ISP. If you're familiar with the old one, you'll note that the word dysfunction has been taken out. So it was a pain arising as a consequence of a dysfunction or lesion affecting the somatosensory system, and that's been taken out, I think, because of there's been such a large amount of work done on the basic science of pain, that and such an awareness that physiological neuroplasticity plays a part probably in every chronic pain disorder, that it was almost starting to be that every chronic pain was a neuropathic pain. And perhaps if you look at the way our patients are treated, lots and lots of chronic pain patients are on antineuropathics, whether or not they would meet this criteria or not. So there is a move to try and narrow down the definition a little bit. I think as a sort of working pragmatic definition, I would say, if nociceptive or inflammatory pain is a normal activation of somatosensory pathways, then neurological pain, neuropathic pain, is an abnormal or pathological activation of those factors somewhere along the incredibly complicated pathway that we now know about. And obviously the task was to talk about the tools, but I think really the what I want to emphasise is that clinician judgment does remain the gold standard diagnostic tool. And in terms of the history, I couldn't have done better than listen to the description from the Silas Weir Mitchell book that Candy read out earlier on of the patient with causalgia, which just, I think it got every symptom and sign and expressed very eloquently as well, and emphasised just how distressing these symptoms can be. But just very quickly, what we're looking for in a history is a history of spontaneous pain, either continuous or paroxysmal. And evoked pain is also a very suggestive sign. Things like clothes and temperature and so on can stimulate that. Having said all that, if you have bad sunburn, you will have both of those symptoms, but in the context of chronic pain, those are very suggestive symptoms. Sensory abnormalities, sensory loss and numbness, and numbness to different modalities is pretty common, as is paresthesia and the sort of abnormal sensations. patients with neuropathic pain are thought to use rather characteristic verbal descriptions, and they come into that concept is very important in some of the assessment tools that I'm going to talk about. But things like burning, shooting, numb and tingling are often used to describe this sort of pain. It's great if you can get your patient to map out a discrete anatomical area for the pain, and probably the most important tool on this slide would be a piece of paper and a pencil, or at least a pencil and a body map. It doesn't have to be an innervation of any particular peripheral nerve, but it should be neuroanatomically logical area. So a diabetic peripheral neuropathy might be glove and stocking, and a post-thalamic stroke might be a hemi body, but it should make sense neurologically in terms of its distribution. A poor response to conventional analgesia is very common. And, you know, for a gold star, if you can actually find a disease or a lesion or an injury to the neurological system, that's great. In terms of the signs, you can't really examine for spontaneous pain, although you can confirm with the patient as you examine them the area that they've described on their body map. You can effectively try and reproduce allodynia, which is, I think it's been mentioned before, but a pain in response to a normally non-painful stimulus, and you can various ways of doing that in the clinic. Thermal is a little bit hard to do in the clinic unless you're lucky and have thermo rollers, which we don't, and these are devices that are kept at particular temperatures. I think it's 20 degrees and 40 degrees, something of that sort. Hyperalgesia with a pin, that's very easy to do. And there, again, you're looking for sensory loss of various modalities. And also, perhaps a little bit more controversially, but certainly in any examination, you would want to check for autonomic signs that have been very well described already. In the dark blue box are the etiologies which are very well associated with neuropathic pain, and these don't tend not to cause any diagnostic confusion or debate. In the light blue box are syndromes that we see very commonly, probably much more commonly than the ones on the left, where increasingly people are diagnosing perhaps an element of neuropathic pain. It might not be the whole diagnosis, but certainly there seems to be an element of neuropathic symptoms and signs in some of these conditions. And there is, I think, now a good deal of uncertainty in diagnosis, and I think that's partly to do with the fact that within any particular neuropathic diagnosis, for example, a sort of common and uncontroversial one, post-herpetic neuralgia, there is a heterogeneity of symptoms and signs within that single disorder. There are at least two subgroups of post-herpetic neuralgia, one which is dominated by a sensory loss and spontaneous pain, and another which is dominated by hypersensitivity and allodynia. So they're all good neuropathic signs, but they don't neatly fit into one underlying mechanism that's to do with that particular illness. And then, for example, the great example is lumbar radicular pain, of which we see lots. There is almost certainly mixed etiology and mixed pain in our patients. There may be inflammatory pain due to wear or tear or joint problems. There may also be an element of nerve compression or nerve scarring that gives a more neuropathic picture. And some of these patients have got very good neuropathic symptoms and signs. And in Michael Bennett, who's written a lot about this, and I've also referenced the French group as well, has come up with an idea that perhaps rather than saying, well, either it is or it isn't neuropathic pain, really, realistically, we'll have to accept our uncertainty and say that in any given patient, we can diagnose pain of a predominantly neuropathic origin, and it's popno, and it's a nice word, nice friendly word, popno. And really, I suppose the real root of the uncertainty in the diagnosis is there is no universally agreed clinical diagnostic criteria for neuropathic pain. which is why essentially the gold standard is still the judgment of an experienced clinician. So how might assessment tools help us? Well, they might, I suppose, improve or standardise our diagnosis, but I think I put a question mark because I think they may help us standardise our diagnosis. I doubt whether they'll help us improve our diagnostic accuracy. We'll come on to that. There might be a way of diagnosing, of quantifying severity. We've got various ways of quantifying severity now, but they might improve the precision of that. They may help us classify and I've alluded to subtypes even within one etiology of neuropathic pain, but it may be of benefit to classify subtypes. And that's because the next point is that if we do get treatments that are specific to specific subtypes, then we'll know which patients to treat with what. It's important that we measure our treatment efficacy, and when we have such distinctly different symptoms and signs, it's nice to see what different modalities the treatment is working on. And there's a very big application for assessment tools in clinical research at this time as well. So if those are our tools, our gold standard tools for our bedside examination, what else have we got? I'm not going to talk about all of these. I don't think time would allow. We've got non-specific pain assessment tools, the simple, well-validated tools like visual analog scores and scores of other dimensions of the pain experience. And these are extremely important. They're not specific for neuropathic pain, and I'm not therefore going to talk more about them. There are a lot of pain questionnaires. I am going to tackle them. And then there's a number of... I put them under the title of tools of the future. They're not tools of the future at all. They're all in use, but not very widely in routine clinical use for assessment. So quantitative sensory testing would be one. There are various electrodiagnostic studies. Biopsy of nerve and skin. And functional neuroimaging. And we'll start with diagnostic screening tools, because this was the big one I had to get through. And there are... lots, there's eight actually. Specific paper-based tools to differentiate neuropathic from nociceptive pain. The first one was the Leeds Assessment of Neuropathic Symptoms and Signs, and that was Matt Michael Bennett's group. And that is a tool that's designed to be administered as a questionnaire with a helper next to the patient, because it also involves some... examination findings. Shortly after, this is a USA group, Wisconsin, Krauss and Bakonja came up with the neuropathic pain questionnaire, similar aims but a slightly different format, and they reduced that down from 12 questions to 3 questions, which was almost as accurate. So those are two others. They're just a questionnaire, but they are designed to have someone help you with it as you fill it in. The Brahesira and the French group produced the Douleur Neuropathique Encapture Questions. Excuse my dreadful accent. That's another tool that's designed to go along with questions and an examination, and they also produced another form of it, which is just the questions, which is validated for postal research, doesn't require an examination. By 2005, Michael Bennett had reviewed the LANS and turned it into, or done another form of it, which is self-assessment, and in this one, it's validated for postal questionnaires again, and the patient fills it in themselves, but they do have to examine themselves. There's two questions at the end where the patient performs their own examination and then answers questions accordingly. 2006, this is a New York group, and they designed another diagnostic questionnaire which was particularly aimed at primary care. It's designed for self-assessment. You can do it on the internet, you can do it by post. And then, as if that wasn't enough, there's a German group who have produced Pain Detect, also with a view to a use in primary care, and this one particularly wanting to tackle the problem of what degree of neuropathic pain do people with low back pain experience. and that was had a particularly the original study involved a large epidemiological study as well. Now I haven't gone into, I'm not going to go into huge details about looking at them all and which questions they use, and because I thought we would all die of boredom if we did that, because there's so many of them and there's so much overlap. I think if anyone is interested, or anyone, you know, wants to use any of these, I've got copies of them all and in electronic form, and I'd be very happy to send you some examples of all or any of these. Just to be put off by the enormity of that side, as a summary, I thought just to look at, because these forms, these ideas are very much based on the verbal discriminatory value of particular ways of describing pain, we just look at the things that the verbal descriptors that are shared, and that's, there we go, there at the top, these are the, this is obviously not all eight forms, this is the original five forms, all of them use these descriptors: pricking, tingling, pins and needles, electric shocks and shooting, and hot or burning. So clearly these are, there will be a general consensus that these are very good symptoms of neuropathic pain. Then there are a couple, numbness and evoking pain from light touch, and pain that's described as cold and freezing, and they are also clearly thought to be pretty good discriminatory words. Then there are a fairly long list of the things that the individual studies have come out with as important descriptors. And this one here, pain limited to joints, is actually a negative descriptor. That is, it's a, you lose a score, you lose a mark if you have that, as this is not thought to be associated with non-neuropathic pain. The purple bits down at the end, these are examination findings, and they relate to evoked pain, allodynia, and these two to a loss of sensation, to a raised sensory threshold. Now, how good are they? There again, this is a big horrible slide with lots of numbers on, and we don't need to go through the validity studies. They've all been validated, all of those tools have been validated, and some, particularly the LANDS, have been validated in many other studies. I think I found three, but I think there's probably more independent validation of the LANDS by now. I have to say the validation, the literature on the validation of these is not great reading. It's pretty hard going, and I wouldn't want to put you through that. What the important thing is all these numbers are very similar, really, aren't they? Their sensitivity is between about 70 and 80 for all of them. You know, some might do better than others, but this is slightly better, but this is not such a precise science, really, that I think that really matters. They're about 70 to 80% sensitive. They're a little bit more specific. And the positive predictive value is about 80%, overall about 80% for all of them. And that suggests to me that it's probably quite a, that it's a reasonable thing to try and do. They're all coming out with reasonably similar numbers, but not forgetting that none of them are much better than 80%. That is, there's 20% of patients that will always be missed if you use this as your only way of diagnosing neuropathic pain. So what are they for? Well, I guess you could argue that it would be good to standardise the distinguishing features of neuropathic pain and make that diagnostic process more reproducible. I think all we can really hope to do is to identify potential cases of neuropathic pain. I think given the error in them, you could never use this to justify ruling out a diagnosis of neuropathic pain in an individual patient. I think there probably is some role for use in outside a chronic pain setting, and I think there's some evidence. Pfizer's Global Neuropathic Pain Survey suggested that neuropathic pain is not very well, certainly not very speedily diagnosed in general practice, and there may be a role for this in general practice. Perhaps, whenever I've done palliative care, they've always been very onto the diagnosis of neuropathic pain, but there might be a role for that in areas like palliative care or orthopaedics. And there's also the thought perhaps this is more relevant in the States. There's also a thought that patients may actually use this to diagnose themselves and then to request referral, because when I did an internet search, I was several of these actual tools on the internet that you could do on the internet and get a score, and then it would tell you, you know, you should go and seek help from a pain specialist. I think really their great use is still in research setting. And they allow the ones that have been validated for postal use, which is the SLANs and the DN4 sensory questions, have been used in large, and actually the pain detect as well, have been used in really huge epidemiological surveys. So Nicola Torrance's publication of 2006, I think they've got 6,000 questionnaires returned and suggested an incidence of pain of predominantly neuropathic origin of about 8% in English population, which is, of course, it's a lot higher than we have thought when we've used an etiological classification to define neuropathic pain. There was another survey with the pain detect in Germany of an even larger number of patients, and they got something like 15% incidence of a neuropathic element in low back pain, and that's of all healthy people. That's in the whole population, not just pain patients. So what are the problems with them? Well, we do, it's probably pretty well accepted that verbal descriptors are useful in pain assessment, but are they really pathognomic? Are they more than just suggesting things to us? And I think I can only say that there's lots written about it and there's conflicting evidence. You can find papers to support both views. They are psychometric tools, that is, they depend on your patient understanding the question, being willing to participate, being able to tick the right box. And there's always, this always gives some degree of error. So don't think they're in any way more objective than a face-to-face clinical assessment. In fact, I should think they're open to more error than that. And so I don't think, certainly in the validity studies, the way these are validated is by comparison with what is generally termed expert clinical judgment. Sometimes it's two expert clinical judgments together, but that's the gold standard, so I think it's hard to see that they could be better than that. And of course, as I said, they'll all miss some neuropathic pain, and so we shouldn't be using these to disprove the diagnosis. And it's perhaps worth mentioning that in the 2004 European Federation of Neurological Sciences guidelines, they're not recommended. They're not recommended actually on the grounds that there is insufficient validation studies, and I'm not sure that argument still holds, because quite a lot of work's been done since then. So, if those are the diagnostic tools, we're doing for time, not well, actually, speed up a bit, there are two pain measurement tools. Now, these are the neuropathic pain scale, Galler and Jensen, 1997, and the same group that did the DN4 have produced a neuropathic pain symptom inventory. And just as a sort of general description, these don't seek to distinguish neuropathic from nociceptive pain. They take neuropathic pain patients and they try to identify the different predominance of the different sorts of symptoms and rate them on a scale. This example, you can't even probably see that. You can either use a global score to create a sort of how bad is it out of 100, or a pain profile, that is, what pattern of pain has this person got? The aim was to predict response to certain therapeutic interventions, and there was the aim to differentiate subgroups of neuropathic pain patients. And subsequent validation studies certainly have shown for the neuropathic pain scale that they are very sensitive to treatment effects. They've not been validated to identify subgroups as yet. And I think probably this is similar enough to the last one that we should skip over it. How useful are these? I think in clinical trials these will prove extremely valuable. They could suggest which sorts of pain respond to which therapies. In clinical practice, I'm not sure. I think they might act as a role as a monitor of treatment effect on different symptoms. And I think perhaps in clinical practice, we don't spend as long with our review patients. We probably rarely re-examine we would rarely repeat a detailed sensory examination on our patients following treatment, and for very reasonable time constraints. And I think a tool like this might allow us to monitor the treatment effects on different symptoms, and generally improve the monitoring of neuropathic pain patients. Tools of the future. I love Star Trek because it's all about the future and it's so dated. And I love the medicine on Star Trek as well, because it's all completely non-invasive and you just go into this little tube and then there's a monitor at your head and it reads out everything. And what we would love would be to be able to put our pain patients in something like that and then look at the monitor and, you know, you could get a quantified score of what sort of pain they were having and what it was like and what it would respond to. Well, not yet, unfortunately. We have got quantitative sensory testing. It's not a tool of the future. That would be wrong to suggest that it was. But it's not in widespread clinical use just now. What it means is the analysis of perception in response to an external stimuli of controlled intensity. And it's in that it differs from a bedside examination. In principle, it's looking at the same things, but it's trying to quantify them and quantify the response. It doesn't replace the bedside examination, not at all. In fact, you couldn't do quantitative sensory testing unless you'd already done a bedside examination, because you wouldn't know which part to test. So it's there to, I suppose, to confirm and to quantify. That's just don't worry too much about that. It's a rather busy slide. But it's just showing that quantitative sensory testing aims to do the same things as a bedside examination with different tools. The one thing it does better, well, the bedside testing is not very good at, is thermal testing, because it's very hard to have precise precise temperatures unless you have a rather big and expensive computer-controlled machine. And if you do, as we do at Garton Abel, although it's I don't think it's ever brought out during clinic, you can do various thermal testings. Bonfrey hairs, there's a picture of them in the slide before, are monofilaments which are designed to bend at a given force so that you can quantify the amount of pressure that you're putting. A tuning fork is probably as good as a vibrometer, as long as it's of a stated frequency. And brush and calibrated pins are not too high-tech. And an algometer is something that will measure a blunt pressure. So, what's our clinical uses? It can't diagnose neuropathic pain, but it may. I mean, that's partly because you can get QST abnormalities in non-neuropathic pain states. But it may reinforce a clinician's certainty about a lesion of the somatosensory system, and it could certainly define the character of a sensory abnormality. Could it guide treatment? Well, there is also conflicting evidence on this, as there is about so much in pain medicine. The first study, Skiffen Eisenberg, found that a cold allodynia was a predictor of a response to epidural steroid, for example. However, the next study found, it was a study with lidocaine patches, that there was no prediction with different symptoms. So I think you just need to watch this space about whether that will ever have that role. It certainly could quantify treatment effects, and it may have a role in that, and it may have a role in that. This looks a bit overwhelming, and the reason I put it up is that this is from a survey by Rolk from the European Journal of Pain, which is from the German Task Force on Neuropathic Pain Research, or something very similar. And we've done an awful lot of work on QST and its role and what its role might be. And they make the point that the protocol of QST is vital. And, of course, it is completely vital. But if you're going to use... clearly, if you're going to use QST to compare one patient with another patient, a set protocol is vital. Otherwise, the results will be meaningless. But even if you just want to compare one patient using the contralateral side as a control and compare that with that same patient 6 months later, it's important that all these things are controlled, that you do the tests in the same way, that the temperature of the room is kept. So it's not it's not an easy thing to do, and it probably is something that needs to be done in laboratory conditions. This is the protocol that the German task force suggests. I'll not go through it all. I think it's great. What they have done is, using this very precise control, they've done gathered quite a lot of data on normal subjects. And in fact, there's 180 normal subjects from 10 different centres, with the aim of producing population norms for all these parameters. And that is, I think that's a great thing. That would be normative data by which any new patient could be compared against. The trouble is, what the next one? I'll go back. The trouble is that the population shows huge variability, and it's very hard. It's not clear how accurate, how sensible a thing it is to try and do. I think the threshold for cold perception in young, healthy women was between 0 and 31 degrees. So we're talking about huge variation. And it may still be better to use the patient's contralateral side or an unaffected part as a control. I just wanted to show you this because I think this is if you do buy into the population, comparing your patients to the population norms, it provides a way of expressing QST results using a Z-score, which is a couple of standard deviations away from the population norm and defined as the norm. That's the grey area. And then all the different, this is cold detection, warm detection, and so on. The point outside the grey area show the abnormalities, and this is illustrating the post-herpetic neuralgia case, which I mentioned before, with the two subtypes, peripheral and central sensitization, being the clear dots. This person has got a highly hypersensitive picture. This is the deafferentation type, where there's generally a sensory loss with spontaneous pain. I think you've got up for a reason, haven't you? That leaves me no time at all to talk about my other things, but I think that's fair enough. I think, really, I suppose, if I can just skip to the conclusion, there's some really interesting stuff here, but what you're missing. We'll get to the conclusion, and I suppose it would be fair enough to concentrate less on those tools, because they're not available in clinical use at the moment, certainly not in this country, and it probably will be a while before they do. And we will have to think carefully about why we're using them, whether we want to subject our patients to a lot more interventions, whether that's going to fuel people's anxiety, whether it's going to suggest to patients that we're going to find them a cure when actually we're just perhaps pursuing things for our own interest. What I want to take away is that there's no agreed clinical criteria for neuropathic pain, and clinical judgment is still the gold standard assessment. That's misspelt. I think we are underway in the process of defining neuropathic pain in terms of its underlying physiological, pathophysiological mechanisms, but we're not there yet. And some of these, the usefulness of some of these tools will have to wait until we are more precise about that. I think there probably is room to improve the precision of our classification in neuropathic pain. Maybe we can just do that with a careful clinical assessment tools, a careful sensory examination in clinic. And remember that, however we hope for an objective measure of pain, it remains a subjective and multidimensional experience, and that probably is assessed better in a face-to-face consultation. Thank you.